I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
In this episode, we return to our conversation with Christina Leith Malin. When I was doing research for this series, I came across a quote from Jordan Peele where he talked about how horror movies are one of the ways the culture exercises their demons. It's not the first time we've heard that description. It comes up when people talk about trends over the years. The subject of this podcast had me questioning how black stories fit in those horror trends that were mostly white narratives. Going back to the beginning of horror cinema, we began with classic monsters, the stories of outsiders or the other, to focusing on outer space and the nuclear age with aliens and giant insects. Then with Cold War fears and psychology going mainstream, we got societal paranoia and betrayals of common norms. In the late 70s and early 80s, white flight landed horror fans in suburbia, only to be invaded by slashers and franchise villains. There wasn't a lot of diversity in those narratives. What they were a reaction to or commentary on is open to interpretation. Throughout the documentary Horror Noir, the idea is presented that African Americans, while not always present in these mainstream movies, are represented in a number of ways. I'm not saying those genres and trends were necessarily a response to race relations, but how often were they? It's conspicuous that movies written, directed, produced, or starring black leads were few and far between. Though even despite the social obstacles and industry hurdles, black cinema had a parallel life going back to the beginning. In our previous episode, Christina Leith Malin mentioned the black filmmaker Oscar Michaud. Michaud was an author, director, and independent film producer in the 1930s and 40s. He made more than 44 films. Described as the most successful African-American filmmaker of the first half of the 20th century, he produced both silent films and sound films dealing with racial relationships and topics like lynching, job discrimination, rape, and mob violence. And there was Richard C. Kahn, a black filmmaker who made over a dozen films, including Son of Ngagi in 1940. Son of Ngagi is a science fiction monster movie that capitalized on the popularity of Ngagi, a racist pre-code exploitation film and precursor to King Kong. Son of Ngagi was written by Spencer Williams, based on his own short story, House of Horror. Spencer Williams is most known for portraying Andy from the Amos and Andy show back in the 50s, but that was much later in his career. Spencer Williams was a filmmaker in his own right, having directed 13 movies, including The Blood of Jesus, which Spike Lee was giving homage to with the title of his Ganja and Hess remake, The Sweet Blood of Jesus. Did you know Spike Lee made a vampire movie in 2014? I didn't. But that goes to my point. I'm not an expert. I've got more questions than I have answers.
If you haven't listened to last week's episode, go ahead, press pause now, listen to last week's episode, then come back in and join us for the second part of our conversation with Christina Leith Malin.
So we've kind of touched on it, the idea that you can trace America's racial attitudes through horror films. So while black people aren't always present in the movies, the idea of the other is often represented as an alien or perhaps a voodoo priest at times or a gorilla.
Send to the ship for anchor chains and tools.
What are you going to do?
To build a raft to float them to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He has always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
I don't know. I think this is not always easy material to talk about and comment on because, like, your haunches go up.
Black history is black horror. The Birth of a Nation was a horror film, especially if you were a black person.
It's one of the first films to be screened in the White House, in Woodrow Wilson's White House. With the endorsement of the president, it feels like policy. There were even advertisements and promotions that said this was essentially based on a true story, and it was as close to fact as one could get.
The Ku Klux Klan is being heralded as the solution to the Black menace.
This is a movie that really solidifies that there's this sort of odd Black lust on the part of Black men towards white women. You see it time and time again, then throughout the horror genre, from King Kong to Candyman.
And so I think people get defensive, and some people just disregard it outright and like, you know, where we had a Black president. We're post-race.
Right. That's one of my favorite things when I
and
hear
now
that.
Now look at us.
Like, oh, we're not racist anymore. I voted for Obama, people will tell you.
I would have voted for him for a third time.
Oh, that's another favorite thing people say. Then they show you, see, I have this Black friend.
Oh, that's the worst. I've got a Black friend.
So you had mentioned Stephen King, and I know you're a big fan, enough so that you participated in the Dollar Babies movie.
Yay!
And making your own MFA project.
Yay.
With One for the Road. Well, sorry, not to drag it down, but I was actually going to transition in terms of like some of the tropes and even some of our favorite movies that happen to be problematic. And Stephen King's work is not devoid of some of the pitfalls. I'm thinking specifically Stephen King. Certainly less these days, but would fall into the magical Negro trope. Characters like in The Shining, where it's Scatman Crothers, or in The Stand
yeah.
with Mother Abigail.
Well, we have to be clear. Like, I love Shining. I love Kubrick. But I don't think it was written in the book that it had to be an old Black man. I don't think. I may have to reread it.
And I think in the book, he survives. That was another choice that Kubrick
made. He does get to live.
Okay, so, I don't want to say that he's problematic. He's a white guy. you write what you know.
I hate to say it, but like Maine is not the most diverse state of things. That's why when they did Under the Dome, the TV show, and there was all different kinds of people of color all over, and I was like, is this Maine?
Where is this?
Yeah. Where is this dome come down? Because it was the day that everyone of color was visiting town.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. Well, okay. So the One for the Road was my first short post graduate work. So, he has this Dollar Baby program where he has a handful of short stories that he will license for exactly $1. And you do have to send a dollar bill in the mail with a contract and all. It was really great. And it was really cool to get selected because I had asked for one once before and never heard back. So this time when I got selected, I was really happy. But it was post my graduate work, and it was an homage piece. Like, mine's super kitschy, I had a Bechdel test to the extent that if you've ever read One for the Road, which is kind of the sequel to Salem's Lot, it's like right after that happened and that town's all deserted. And then a family, a husband, wife, and a daughter, their car breaks down right outside Jerusalem's lot. And so dad goes to look for help and then comes back and his family's gone. My whole idea, it was not just a Bechdel for females, but it was also kind of a color thing, was that the family would be a mixed family, Black dad, white mom, and that way I could use my daughter in the cast, considering my husband's white and she's caramel. So that was one consideration. Another consideration was that the bar owner and the bar owner's best friend were two guys that the father goes to find. And I made it two women. I thought of it as the widow of the bar owner and her best friend. And then I reversed it. So I made the Black woman, the bar owner, and her best friend white. But I made sure that both people had a backstory. I also made sure that they weren't like 40-something hot bar owners, but they were all women of a certain age over, you know, because I feel like you don't see enough older women. You don't see enough women, mm-hmm. women of color, older women in things. And it works out that the bar owner happened to be Beverly Bonner of Basket Case. And her best friend, Christy Sanford, was in Satan's Playground. So these two women have done B-horror, which was really cool. So it was very kitschy to that. And then the crew was 90% female crew. So my AC, my DP, my group supervisor, my AC and AD, all women. I had my gaffers and two PAs were men. FX was a woman. So we had like about 15 women and about 4 men total on set to shoot the film. And that was like, my dream. And it was also the first time I had a budget that would say over 10,000, which still is like change in the world. But for me, it was something, you know? So it was like this homage to like my favorite writer, a lot of women. And the funniest thing is, on a number of occasions, I had a lot of the crew women coming to me and saying, oh, you know, FYI, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay, thank you. And they would come back to me and go, you know, usually, I remember specifically my script supervisor, she told me how many times when she was on sets that her directors would say, don't worry about it, babe, and just like relegate her. And she's like, thank you for listening to me. And it really sucks that a woman would have to say thank you for listening to me because it wouldn't be the norm. But that's, you know, it is what it is. So that's why One for the Road was everything to me. And I would love to do more like 75% up woman crewed and cast things. I just love it. The vibe was great. It's really great.
And when you put it together, did you have that in mind, or is that kind of how it started to shake out?
No, I planned it that way. And I mean, I did, like, in my post-production, it was 50-50 because my editor and my sound or my sound designer were male. But then me and my effects girl were female. So it was 50-50 on the post. But I knew I was going to go heavy when I started searching for people on Mandy and through friends. I knew I was going to go heavy on women. That sounds weird.
So that we're all kind of shaped by our upbringing in terms of like what horror connects with us. In my case, I grew up a little more brown than anybody in my, you know, predominantly white town. And so the idea of like walking into a store and knowing that all eyes were going to be on me. Now I happen to love paranoia stories where people are, you know, watching you without your knowing. Christina, I'm curious, is there a subgenre of horror that kind of pushes your button specifically?
In a good way or a bad way?
In a good way?
Well, either way, I guess.
Okay, I'm going to give you good and bad. In a good way, a subgenre that I like paranormal. Like, I am all for the Paranormal Activity, all of it. The Entity, The Exorcist is still my number one freak out. I could watch that and still curl up like a little girl. Yeah, just that whole thing with like floating objects and yeah, paranormal just, yeah, in a good way. In a bad way, extreme gore. Because as a filmmaker, and I love horror, I've finally come to the point, I've finally seen the two movies that said, I said, you know, I have a limit, and yeah, you're outside of my range. And that would be a Serbian film, Human Centipede 2, and Grotesque. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay. Yeah, you didn't need to be made. I love horror, and yeah, you didn't need to be made.
That must have made investigating New French Extremity kind of challenging because they can push some boundaries.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Catch 22. Martyrs and French Martyrs. I thought it was excellent because it was at the core. Had you not gotten even the chick in the bathtub, had you not gotten the skin rip, it still was an amazing story about friendship, about trust. And then about like the whole idea, I feel like the third act was more a Twilight Zone about old people wanting to see what the afterlife was. So there was gore, but the core of that, it made sense. Funny enough, L'Interieur, Inside, was the centerpiece of my master's degree. And I had just given birth to my daughter.
Oh, wow.
A couple of years. So in the middle of my thesis crit, I had a meltdown and started crying. because of what the movie, I think had I done that before having a child, I would have been like, oh, it's really deep, it's really heavy. After having a child, it hit me in such a surreal way. You take it a lot differently. I struggled with who to empathize with. And then I don't know if you've ever seen, and a total shout out to the Dimensions Extreme DVD of that, but if you've ever seen that DVD with the behind the scenes, they show you the shooting of that very last scene. And when they shot that scene and then they called coupe or cut, the two women just bawled hysterically on the steps, and the whole set was afraid and quiet and frozen. And it was something I've never had such chills in my life. And I was like, that is cinema on another level. Yes, it is extremely gory, but it's another level. That is not Human Centipede 2. That is not a Serbian film. Even with a Serbian film, the director said, well, this is my testament to Serbian. He tried to come up with an afterthought for a horrific slew of events movie. You know,
right. Yeah.
Totally different from the New Wave Extremities, whereas they actually had solid films.
I love, for me, I'm kind of on the opposite. I love gore. It sounds awful when you say it, but there's something that when I say it, but there's something I find really ingenious about ultra violence. And so Inside to me is one of those films, though. The violence can't be for violence sake. It has to be driven by the story. And Inside,
agreed,
the violence is driven entirely by that story and those circumstances. Something like, I always talk about it because it's one of my most favorite films, Calvaire. An incredibly,
oh, I love Calvaire. That was in my thesis too.
It's one of my most favorite movies and no one ever knows it. Love it. But the violence is driven by the story. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's what it takes. It's not violence for just violence sake. But on the idea of Human Centipede 2, I will always defend those kind of movies because, to me, the gore in that case is just the plain art of it. And it gives you a reaction, whether you hate it or whether you love it, it gives you a reaction. So it's not my cup of tea, but I'll always defend their right to make that kind of film because that's horror on a different level.
I will give you that. What I will say on that end is I specifically pinpointed gore that, like, grotesque, I'm not going to get behind. But I do love ultraviolence. I dug Itchy the Killer, all of your suicides, Noriko's Dinner Table, Battle Royale, which is the real Hunger Games.
Right.
So, like, I dig that. But again, we have plots. Grotesque is a guy that just wants to cut people apart. That's the news at 7. So a Serbian film is, would you dare? Like, I dare you to do this. Dare you? That still doesn't, that's not a plot. Just as you cleverly think of a horrible ending, that's not a plot. Calvaire, a village of men that are so in a psychosis about missing one freaking woman or all the women that they turn a poor little comedian into main course.
Yeah, I love it. It's so good. But that's like, you know, the violence in that is also...
it makes sense. Part,
yeah, it makes incredible sense. It's physically violent, but it's mentally violent to me. I mean, I think that's why it's such a great film all around. But
and it has a psychological there is a really deep psychological story with that movie.
Right. And so that's where I love that kind of... That's kind of my thing. And I don't know why. I can't tell you why. That's my thing. I get your idea of paranoia. I get, like, where that comes from. I don't know why I like to see gross, crazy shit, but I do.
You two are the best. Paranoia with gore.
Darren would be like, are these entrails mine? I don't know. That's the paranoia story.
So for the moment, we're going to leave it at that. We're going to come back and we're going to go into a deep dive into Ganja and Hess and Get Out with Christina Leith Malin. But for now, we're gonna throw to you, Christina. Where can people find you online? Where can they find My Final Girl and your documentary work?
Oh, awesome. Yeah, it's a very long URL, myfinalgirl.com. That's it.
I was thinking as you said that, I go, no, it's not.
And I'm KLM Brooklyn on Twitter and Instagram and KLMBrooklyn.com. as well. And I actually do have Bechdel and lots of feminist resources on softdigitalnetwork.com. Boom.
Cool. Yeah. And I mentioned I love the website. It is both fun and informative. But yeah, check it out, listeners. And we'll have links in the show notes as well, so we'll make it easy to track down. And Christina will join us again very soon to talk about Ganja and Hess and Get Out. And as far as our stuff, you know where to find us on social media. We are at Rance Macabre on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, as well as therancemacabre.com. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. And
leave us a review. Give us stars.
Yeah, give us stars.
All
give us
things.
Reviews.
Why
all
not?
The things. So, yeah, we'll leave it there for now. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
Christina. Kaylin Brooklyn. What? My final girl.
The Rance Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated.